Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, October 25th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. There was an absolutely stunning and crucial intervention into mankind last weekend with a conference held by the Schiller Institute near Frankfurt, Germany, which was a commemoration of the 30-year anniversary of the founding of the Schiller Institute in 1984. It's absolutely critical that at this moment of a profound and existential crisis facing mankind, that there is an opportunity to focus on the real dangers that we face, to have a serious dialogue on what policy options exist, as well as to celebrate that which is unique about the human race, which makes it worth the effort to save it. After all, we're not dinosaurs, a life form that was incapable of acting to save itself. Presumably, we have within us the qualities necessary to address these crises and overcome them and enter into a new paradigm of human activity in the solar system. And in opening the conference, Helga Zepp LaRouche laid out the confluence of the three crises which confront us. The crisis of terrorism, which is leading us toward a nuclear World War III, the crisis of the global collapse of the financial institutions, which will probably get a big push over this weekend with the release of the stress tests in Europe, either because of the blatant lying or because of the reality of what's happening with the banking system there. And third, with the dangers of the Ebola crisis and the absolutely deliberately incompetent efforts to address it, which threatens the world with a new bubonic plague, 14th century type, extinction level event. So on the program today, we're going to hear from two participants in that conference. First, we'll hear from Elke Thimmen, who is a leader of the Busso and the Schiller Institute in Germany, a longtime associate of Lyndon and Helga Zepp LaRouche. And then in the second half hour, we'll hear from Jason Ross, who also attended the conference. He's a member of the LaRouche basement team, and he gave a very interesting presentation at the conference on LaRouche's economics and the relationship to physical chemistry. So we'll hear from Jason later, but let me open by welcoming Elke to the program. Hello, Elke.
Hello.
Now, this was quite an event, and we can't really encompass it in the hour we have today, but I'd like to start by just situating it in the context of this being the 30th anniversary. 30 years ago, there was a similar kind of confluence of crises when Helga Zepp LaRouche took the initiative to found the Schiller Institute. And I'd like you to give our audience your sense of the continuity of the fight over the 30 years and the importance, therefore, of the conference today, based on what we've done over those 30 years.
Yeah, well, I think maybe the best characterization of this conference, which actually was attended by about 400 guests over these 2 days from 5 continents and 25 countries, is to say that it is an absolutely good example for universal history in action. And I mean that both the ideas which are represented by the work of Lyndon LaRouche, by Helga Zepp LaRouche over all these years, in the concrete work of the Schiller Institute and beyond, are really shaping history and have shaped history in a way that at this point we are really in a situation where we can say that all the ingredients to bring the historic situation to a good new level for mankind are there, and that certainly is to a very, very large extent the work of the Schiller Institute, and just proves that ideas matter. Not only do ideas matter, but also they transform history, and that was proven again in this absolutely fascinating conference which we held now in Frankfurt.
Well, you know, the concept of this being an example of universal history in action, I think, is really significant, because that does bring us to the very idea that Schiller had about how man must base his actions in the world. And it's important that the intervention of the LaRouches has been on political, economic, historical level, but also profoundly important to bring in the cultural question. And you know, this was very prominent in the conference this last weekend.
The other really striking experience for all the participants as well as the speakers, I think, was that there was really a complete unity in the sense of discussion, of the discussion level, while we did have this great diversity in terms of countries, in terms of different backgrounds of people. But the whole concept of this conference and the level of discussion was actually geared towards how can we create the future. And that was something which was a quite extraordinary experience, I think, for everybody, because faced with all these extremely grave crises and actually the abyss of losing civilization, the concepts which were presented, especially from the speakers from China, India, but also many other countries, showed that there is a solution, and that really if mankind and every nation in the world and every individual mobilizes his potential, then we can really achieve a solution and bring mankind in cohesion with the laws of the universe instead of accepting the oligarchical dictatorship under which society and mankind is suffering right now. And this idea of the unity or unity and diversity together is this concept of Nicholas of Kurs, which really was there very, very, very much present in all the discussions and in the whole spirit of this in this conference. And of course, the discussion centered a lot on the New Silk Road, which the Chinese speakers especially presented, the initiatives of Chinese president, the Chinese president, to bring those really on the table and make it a focus of discussion in Europe and worldwide, and that gave people a very good sense of what it means to connect culture, history, politics, all in one. Because only if we have another view of mankind, which is not geopolitical, can we get really out of this current mess.
Well, we've spoken before on this program of the ironies that you have some of the oldest civilizations, the Chinese civilization, Indian civilization, and Egyptian civilization, civilizations that were, in much of the modern history, suppressed under colonial policies, that now you have this emergence with the BRICS of these old civilizations with the newest, most innovative ideas in science and technology. And that what Helga Zepp-LaRouche emphasized on her return from her recent trip to China was the optimism she saw in China compared with the pessimism in Germany and the unworldly unreality of delusion in the United States. And I from what I can tell from what I've seen so far of the reports, this optimism was there throughout the whole conference, the optimism that there are solutions and the only way to face this kind of crisis is to present solutions. Why don't you say a little bit, we had speakers from India and China who gave very interesting presentations. You brought up the Silk Road. I assume this became very real to people from Europe, that this is something that's not pie in the sky, but it's being done right now.
I mean, it also comes on the immediately after this conference came immediately after the conclusion of the visit of Li Keqiang to Germany and also to Italy. And in this context, I would just like to mention that also Helga Zepp-LaRouche had been interviewed again on the Chinese-German and Chinese-European relations at the conclusion of that visit, which I think was on October 15th. So one point which became very clear is that the Schiller Institute, and that was also expressed by the speakers, is really the one organization which is right now organizing to make this the reality and put this concept on the table in a very concrete way in Germany. And there is nobody else. I mean, nobody, and that one has to realize, did something like what we did with this conference. You know, you organize a conference, you have people from all over Europe, all over the world, you discuss very concretely how this concept of cooperation of the Chinese policy, the One Road, One Belt policy, how that can be concretized. And that is something which is very, very unique. So the Schiller Institute is the first movement in Europe to organize a public platform to discuss this topic and to make it, to really put it in action in Germany, in France, in Italy, in all the other countries. And I think this is very important to realize this. And in fact, this was quite strongly expressed in these speeches which we heard, especially the one speech by Professor Xi Se, who is the from the China Institute of International Studies in Beijing, who elaborated as a second speaker after Mrs. LaRouche on the innovative ideas concerning the mode of cooperation along the Silk Road. And that is a very, very interesting speech. I mean, all the speeches are extremely interesting, and I just invite everybody to go to the New Paradigm site of the Schiller Institute to in-depth study these speeches, because they are absolutely rich with ideas and with concrete concepts which you then can value much better. But he made very clear, he said right in the beginning of his speech, that he had been at many conferences about One Road, One Belt in China, but that this was the first time for him to participate in this kind of a conference abroad. And he also said that normally, principally, these questions are being discussed. What does it mean? But now the challenge is to develop the concept and practice of innovation, how to really put this all into practice and that therefore it is so important to have this kind of conference. And he said this: the discussion of building a one road and one belt system of reform and innovation, which is an open concept with China reaching out to all the other countries, has already become a matter of practical deliberation, and that he saw the conference especially as a place to actually make progress in that matter. Then there was also the speech or two speeches from representatives of the China Sung Ching Ling Foundation, which is the foundation which upholds the memory of Sun Yat-sen's wife, the first president of China. And they stressed very, very much that this conference and what they heard the day before, because they spoke at the second day, that this presented them with stimulating ideas, gave new perspectives, and that they themselves had organized a conference right now a couple of months ago, which Helga Zepp-LaRouche attended in China, on this concept of the Silk Road, and that now, after very shortly after, you have this conference here in Europe on this concept, the New Silk Road and China's Lunar Program, which is really a highlight of the 30 years excellence of the Schiller Institute, and an absolute example for how Madame Helga Zepp-LaRouche connects her deep thinking on human development with her China Silk Road experience, and that this would lead now to many more steps and to the building of a new international order based on development and human culture. So this is, I mean, I'm just saying this. And then there was a third speech by a professor who unfortunately couldn't come in person, Professor Dr. Wang Zuo Wu, the dean of the School of Nuclear Science and Technology from Lanzhou University in China, who spoke about the future perspectives of nuclear power in the new era of the Silk Road. And that also was an extremely interesting speech where he really showed what are the tasks now in China to develop nuclear power, to get to a new level of performance of the economy and productivity, and how this all is part of a living process to really put these into action. And then lastly, let me just say that there was also two speakers actually from Iran. And one was Dr. Fatemi Hashemi, who is the Secretary General of the Women's Solidarity Association of Iran. And she spoke about the role of Iran in the Silk Road, which of course dates back three millennia, if you look at history.
Right.
And she said in the end that the Schiller Institute, which has a brilliant and credible history of efforts to maintain and ensure peace and progress for all nations fighting against war and violence and launching endeavors for respecting human rights and dignity, is propelling the public opinion towards global peace through holding such conferences. And so that's that I just quoted at some length to give you some idea of what I meant with, you know, universal history in action, because that was somehow the sense of this conference with the people participating, that this concert of nations and history and civilization is really shaping a new level for the future on which we can build, sort of like an invisible bridge into the future.
You're listening to Elke Thimmen, who is a leader of the Schiller Institute from Germany, who's reporting on the conference which just took place last weekend. Now it seems like it's so long ago, given all these reports. But the proceedings will be on the Schiller Institute New Paradigm site, and you can watch them for yourself. And I urge you to take the time to do it. Now, Elke, as you were talking about some of the speakers, especially Professor Shise, I was thinking about this question of that was brought up constantly, cooperation and innovation. And the theme of the conference was a new paradigm to create a golden renaissance. And I was thinking about Cusa and the Council of Florence and his work, his scientific work, which triggered the renaissance of the golden renaissance of the 15th century. I mean, it's clear that this is the only way that you can generate the kind of ideas that are necessary to get out of these crises, but it's very much along the same kind of lines. This, again, to go back to universal history, this does bring to life the work of Cusa, Kepler, and others.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, the other absolute important ingredient of this conference was the role of music, of classical music, and which is really addressing and touching the source of human creativity, you know, and that became very, very clear. We had in the beginning the first conference day started with a small chorus of the Schiller Institute, which sang the sequence from Haydn's Creation and the New World. And that was really a very, very good introduction to the theme of the conference, which is the creative principle as the law of the universe and mankind. And that was actually something which also Ray McGovern, who was one of the very, very much greeted speeches at that conference because he represents the better America, right, took up in his speech, and in fact, he actually sang the sequence which comes right before, where it says, and then it becomes, then light occurs, or light, I don't know the English
way to
say it. Yeah, there shall be light, or there is light. And that was very, very moving, because, you know, that was an example of how people took up these kind of very, very deep concepts and were touched by it. And then, of course, we did have the in the evening of the first conference day a musical evening under the direction of Sergei Stritt with a scenic performance of Fidelio, the only opera which Ludwig van Beethoven ever wrote. And that was really absolutely, I mean, breathtaking. And somehow it was a culmination and a kind of working through, you know, of all the contributions of the day, the tension between the immediate danger of an apocalypse, which we have to solve, on the other side, all the possibilities which are there. And so in this opera performance, especially with the person of Leonora, who frees her husband, Fidelio, this became very personal and very direct, you know, how it's possible through the power of love for mankind, love for your spouse, you know, but love, to really get rid of the worst tyranny of oligarchy and achieve freedom, not only personal freedom, but also freedom for mankind. And that was just breathtaking, and people were sort of speechless in a good way afterwards, because then most of them never heard that opera and didn't know it exists. But then also how it was presented came across so powerful that it strengthened in an extremely strong way this moral faculty, you know, which really we need, and to awaken that, and this security that you can change the world for the better, you know. And that was somehow also the theme of which went through the whole conference, which gave people this kind of strengthening to really tackle all these great crises which we have today. And it was also reflected in the speech of the representative of the Sung Ching Ling Foundation, Madame Pai Hua. And she presented Helga and her colleague Chen Bo. They presented Helga with a classical music instrument, percussion instrument of the Han Chinese in ancient China, and also underlined in her speech that really what you need is this kind of classical culture as a basis for cooperation of all the countries which are building this new world. So that was very, very beautiful. And I think that was somehow the overriding emotion of people who came out of this conference.
And again, you have this constant dialogue between these really old cultures, which had moments of golden ages based on science and exploration. And then Europe, which, you know, is a relatively young culture compared to China and India and Egypt, but that the flowering of the period from the Council of Florence up through the Weimar classical period, an incredible wealth of ideas concerning this question of the creative principle in man. And then we look around us today at a culture which is so degenerate, so horrifying, and yet from it, by looking at what mankind has been through crises before, and it's always been the reassertion of this creative principle that allowed us to emerge from it. And I think that's one of the things that's really important from the conference, because we're talking about the other part of the conference, which is very exciting, was the discussion of things such as the New Silk Road itself, but also the space program. And I'd like you to just say a little bit about Helga emphasized in her keynote the importance of the Chinese lunar mission, but this was very much a key part of the conference.
Yeah, absolutely, and I can only encourage everybody to watch Helga's speech, because there should be included the video clip which she showed also in the end of this moon landing. And you must imagine, you know, here you have this almost 400 participants to the conference. There were not only speakers from China, but there were also various other representatives from China, both from press and diplomatic and others. And so they are hearing a speech. They are seeing a speech which celebrates the Chinese absolute, you know, breathtaking and super developments and for mankind with this kind of lunar program, and it was really absolutely moving to see this and to see this film of this landing, you know, and I think everybody took great joy of the participants to see this. And Helga also before had video clips of the old Silk Road, the new Silk Road, and all these things, and it was really so it was so actual, you know. It was like you are there, you are there in this process, and to discover the universe, to be part of this great endeavor, and that was both for the Chinese guests. It was absolutely great, because here they are in Europe, and, you know, there are all these people around them celebrating China for this great achievement. And on the other side, all the other people from all these other countries who were really completely happy about it and giving a real I mean, having this kind of common aims of mankind, and that everybody would really enjoy this and not look at it from a geopolitical standpoint and say, now we must crush this because they are the first and we want to be first. No, it was a genuine spirit of happiness about these achievements. And I must say that also the other contributions, and I didn't talk about them, there were many excellent contributions from delegations from and people from Africa, from Europe, of course, contributions dealing with the question of how to figure Europe into this new Silk Road and BRICS development. Very fascinating, like Mediterranean bridging, something which the Schiller Institute has been promoting for a long time, and all sorts of other. All sorts of other contributions, and of course the science panel, which Jason obviously will say more about, because he was also the keynote speaker in that panel. But I think this sense of cultural optimism, where everybody could find himself or herself, and also his or her nation, that was the most exciting about it. And also, I mean, this time, unfortunately, we didn't have a bigger delegation from Russia. But I would also say that those people who attended who also sent greeting messages, like Professor Mikhail Titarenko, the director of the Institute of Far East Studies of the Russian Academy of Sciences, who has been a longtime friend of Lynn and Helga, and also other people in the audience from Russian origin, they felt at home in this, you know, because this is really this BRICS perspective to build the future, and that came across very strongly also when Natalia spoke on Ukraine, on this horror show which we see there. We also had a lady representing a famous cultural event organization in Baden-Baden, which every year organizes these cultural events in Russian culture, high level, who spoke. And, you know, that was another one of these elements where you could see that really we have to cooperate. We cannot tolerate anymore this war policies, and we are just in this all together, and we have to find a solution all together, which includes really every continent, including Australia, from where we had a delegation, and also a greeting a message sent by the former Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, which was, of course, very important. So these are, I'm just elaborating a bit on this, because I think this idea of we are together creating the future, both to conquer space, to conquer deadly diseases, to green the deserts, and really create a beautiful future for mankind. This kind of basis was woven like a invisible bond between people who participated in there. And you did not hear, as often is the case, especially in Germany, lots of pessimism or so in discussions, but people were generally excited and got a taste of what it means if Germany decides to become again the country of Leibniz, of Bach, of Beethoven, and of Schiller. And this is also what Tony Kestner stressed in his speech, where should Germany be 50 years from now? But it was all this idea of human creativity as a bond which unites peoples and individuals.
Well, given that we live in a world that's dominated by this financial oligarchy that's defined by geopolitics and Darwinian struggle, this is the kind of moment where you actually present what really man does represent. And Elke, thank you very much for your report. It's very exciting. And where can people see these videos? It's the Schiller Institute New Paradigm site, is that right?
Yes, exactly. So we are working now, our video team is working day and night to put these videos on, first in English so that they can have international circulation, and then also in the other languages. So for now we do have audios mostly and then written speeches, but I just encourage everybody to just start working and to throw himself or herself into this kind of process, to really be part of this exciting movement which is now taking off.
Well, it's clear that this had a profound effect on you, because this was a very exciting report from you, Elke. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you very much. And I just would like to conclude by saying that the United States were very, very much present in the conference. The importance of the U.S., the importance of the U.S. coming back to its constitution. And after all, the founding of the Schiller Institute is based on the intent of the U.S. Declaration of Independence. So we are looking very much forward to seeing the needed changes in the United States, so that that we can really have concert of nations working together.
All right. Well, that's a very important ending for you. Thank you again, Elke. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Very good. Take care. Bye bye.
Okay. Bye. So that was Elke Fimmen from the German organization of the Schiller Institute, also BUSO, the political party that was founded by Helga Zepp-LaRouche on the conference from last weekend. And now we're going to bring in an old friend of the program, who's not really that old, Jason Ross, who was able to attend the conference. And actually, Jason, it must have been very interesting for you, because I understand before you got to the conference, you were in the great Renaissance city of Florence, is that right?
That's true.
So you had a chance to see the dome and to see the fruits of the old Renaissance, which are still there. So give us your impression. I know, for people who don't know this, Jason led off the weekly webcast, Lyndon LaRouche webcast, on the LaRouche Pack last night. And it's archived for you, and in it he gives a very thorough report on the conference. But what really struck me, Jason, is that your comments on, I guess it was Helga in the question and answer period, who called on the people of our planet to fall in love with the human race, to have that kind of emotional connection to the beautiful potential of a creative mankind. And you know, maybe you can start with that, because I think that was reflected in what Elke said and quite profound. But I assume that somewhat permeated the whole conference.
Well, it did. It did. You know, beyond the pieces, but I think what Elke was saying about the composition of the conference as a whole, the fact that this was a public platform to discuss this topic, that people who are working on it, like she mentioned, Professor Xi Zi, this was his first international conference on the subject, that we're really making possible this discussion that has to happen, this planning that has to happen to have this future for ourselves. So it really, you know, it sort of built up and developed throughout the thing and was there more strongly by the end than when it began, I think, because of the effects of the dialogue and the discussion. And, you know, there were two things at the very end, closing discussion period, that both, you know, really hit me. One was what Helga had said that I brought up last night, and that you just talked to God about falling in love with. If you'd fall in love with mankind the way you first ever fell in love, have that kind of feeling for mankind's potential.
Uh-huh.
And then another thing, just about the power of the BRICS, on a question about combating Ebola, Jayashree Sengupta, the Indian economics analyst, she had pointed out that India could quite possibly help with this. India's got an advanced biological research capability, and that already India's pharmaceutical industry is assisting developing nations with HIV and AIDS. And, you know, when she said that, not that, you know, she's not a biologist, she's not running this pharmaceutical plant or anything like that, but hearing that from an Indian, when India actually is moving forward and doing these things, I thought to myself, wow, I can take seriously as something that, you know, might actually happen, what she's saying about this. But if India says it will do something like that, it's serious, and people around the world know that when Obama says he's going to do something, he isn't. So it's just, I don't know, it was
and
like
Jason,
sort of
I think the other irony there is that you have this call from Dr. Osterholm. We had Deborah Freeman on last week, and she was going through Osterholm's call for a Manhattan-style project to develop a vaccine, and not just 500,000, but 500,000,000 doses must be produced. And I was thinking about this from the standpoint of the Darwinian world of the pharmaceutical companies, which dominate, along with insurance companies and for-profit hospitals, healthcare in the United States, how angry the pharmaceutical companies are that the Indians are committed to mass production of generic drugs that make it affordable. And so, in listening to what she said about the Indian capability, this is a revolution. You can do, you know, people who think we're stuck permanently with insurance companies and too big to fail banks and the pharmaceutical industries, they can be brought to their knees in a minute. And that's really the power of the human race if we actually deploy it.
Yeah, and the importance of having it as a social intention. I mean, when you know, when you have government financed research, when if the NIH or the CDC was doing much more work and giving much more grants on these things, and then those discoveries are, you know, public as opposed to when they're financed by pharmaceutical companies, you know, it's a totally different kind of world. You know, when
Jason,
you say, hey, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm.
In your presentation, you spoke about, it was a very provocative presentation on LaRouche's approach to physical economy. And I'd like you to just give a synopsis, because I think you didn't get a chance last night in the webcast, but I thought your presentation really challenged people to think differently about economics. So I'd like you to just summarize what you said.
Yeah, I was a little bashful last night. I'd already gone on a long time, didn't want to give a long summary of what I said.
Well, here's your opportunity, but we don't need a long summary, just a succinct one.
Okay. Well, you know, the theme of China's helium-3 lunar, you know, development orientation, you know, that was an important thing that Helga had brought up right from the beginning in her opening keynote. And this was an opportunity to put some flesh on the bones on that and make it clear what they're doing. And to do that, it was necessary to put that in context. So overall, the development of economy, LaRouche says, goes hand in hand with the development of higher forms of fire from Prometheus and higher types of physical chemistry. So I went over both of those briefly. On the fire front, looked at the U.S. per capita use of energy, and we could see how wood as a fuel source was supplanted by coal, which has then been largely supplanted by petroleum and natural gas. And then nuclear power was created, but never really went anywhere. Nuclear is a small sliver of our energy use in the United States right now. And why is that? Why didn't it increase? And also looked at from the standpoint of the types of physical knowledge that we have, that in the physical world of, you know, we had physical machines, winches and levers and things like that. But with the chemical revolution, first in metallurgy, with the chemical production of metals out of rocks using charcoal, and then with the use of the combustion or the steam engine and the combustion engine, you know, we really released a new type of power that let us do things that before we had to do with our bodies or those of animals or, you know, wind. Then as far as nuclear goes and getting into that, you know, it felt particularly fun going over nuclear power in Germany, where I think people are more afraid of that than they are of Ebola. But, you know, people think nuclear power is based on radiation, which it isn't. I mean, radiation is actually very weak compared to fission, which is the basis of power in a nuclear plant. And we went through what fusion is, went through a few of what the different nuclei are and how they would combine and why helium-3 was a whole order of power beyond the fusion that's discussed today, and how the fire of helium-3 fusion won't involve heat. It will be really the first time that we could have a mass-scale source of power that's not based on the heat aspect of fire. Instead, it would be based on the creation of charged particles. We could directly create energy, etc. So, It was fun to have the opportunity to go through LaRouche's concept of platforms as a basis for understanding economics in the large scale, and also this concept of Prometheus, of fire, of physical chemistry, and on participation in that process being the goal for the development of society. That people, that the goal of government is to, you know, we obviously have to supply physical necessities, starvation, poverty, these things. And looking beyond that, the goal of government has to be to provide people an opportunity to participate in that developing process, to really have a human identity, to leave something that's uniquely human behind.
Well, you know, it's interesting from that standpoint that it's a natural process of the evolution of human knowledge. It's only when it's artificially stopped, as it is with the Greenie movement, with the Bertrand Russell faction takeover of science, that we're going in some ways that are unnatural. And I thought it was also interesting, it must have been very interesting for German participants to hear Tony Kastner's presentation on where Germany could be in 50 years. I would say a little bit about that, because I thought that was also quite interesting.
Yeah, well, I think that I must confess that one of the opportunities of being able to watch a conference online is that you can pause it when you need to, which you can't always do when you're in person. So I missed part of Tony's presentation.
Uh-huh.
But it's true. I mean, the image of Germany that he presented for 50 years in the future looks very little like what most Germans would consider Germany ought to look like 50 years in the future, or at least like what, you know, the official, you know, government or press says Germany should look like, which would be a bunch of people, I don't know, doing organic farming outdoors and, you know, not building any new trains or anything like that. Compared to Tony's vision of nuclear science, nuclear power, the development of new infrastructure like the cargo cap. So it was, you know, that's the real German tradition. And Germany obviously has a major, major, major history in these upward developments. I mean, Germany's got an incredible culture of, you know, culture and the science, and, you know, the insanity of rejecting that under the idea of being green is, you know, it's a repudiation of humanity and, you know, being German in a certain way, too.
Well, and also, Jason, I think what's really quite important is to get a sense of the complete clash between the world of the oligarchy, the International Monetary Fund, with its conditionalities, which has proven to be a failure everywhere their economic policies are carried out, and yet that's still what's being proposed for the developing sector. Then you look at countries such as Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, where the Ebola outbreak is out of control, and you realize that they've been destroyed by the IMF. And so you mm-hmm. have on the one hand, and also then you look at a country like Greece. I know there's a speaker from Greece there. You know, Greece has a 50% drop in its living standards since the euro was introduced. So you have on the one hand an oligarchy which is saying you have to stick with these policies. You have to stick with the green policies, the austerity policies. And these are failing. And then all of a sudden it's as though there's a light bulb turned on in a dark cave. And people see, wow, this is not the future. The future is something totally different. So I think
right.
it's important for our listeners to realize that they have to embrace this idea of the future or they're going to die. This civilization is dying, and that's one of the points that Lyndon LaRouche is emphasizing, and it comes through very clearly from the totality of the conference. But unless people understand that, you know, they might think, well, these are nice ideas, and it would really be good if we could do these things, but there is reality.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this reality leaves you dead. And you know, I know that you've been working with the basement team on developing these concepts of energy flux density, knowledge, the Prometheus concept, and you know, you must have the kind of sense that you were like Christopher Columbus standing on the deck of the ship looking into the future.
Well, yeah, it's sort of like you've got a, you know, you go to the you go to your doctor and they say, well, you know, your health's not the best. You really ought to be taking some cyanide. And if you start taking the dose of cyanide they give you, and you're actually feeling worse. And they say, oh no, it's worse than we thought. We better double your dose. And you know, although some low-level people in the IMF or World Bank may be unaware that that's the result of the conditionalities they impose, from the top, it's known. I mean, the, you know, the IMF is used as a tool to prevent the development of nations. both by, you know, what it gives loans for and what it doesn't, and then the conditionalities. So, you know, Greece is an excellent example, that dramatic drop in living standards that you mentioned. The same with Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine's been playing by all the IMF's rules for, you know, over two decades. It's doing what the WTO says, and it's destroying the economy. So, you know, this gets at a way of getting out of all of this, which is, you know, do people have the internal sense of knowing something to be able to get away from popular opinion? In other words, do we have people, do we have a society where there's genuine knowledge that's based on, you know, on making discoveries as opposed to repeating what somebody's heard? You know, without that, you don't really have any basis to have different opinions. You don't really have any basis to stand on something. And then I think those countries that have done it, I mean, you know, Iceland didn't, you know, freeze and fall off the planet when it didn't bail out its banks. You know, Argentina proved that there is life after the IMF. And, you know, it's one of the things Ray McGovern talked about, is how the countries of Europe aren't even sovereign. I mean, they don't even make their own decisions anymore. And it's just pathetic that they're not acting in their own self-interest or even as nations at all. Because the policies that would...
This is one of the themes of Helga Zeppler-Rusch on the question of the Peace of Westphalia, that the idea of forgiving past indiscretions, including debt and wars, acting for the benefit of the other. But then the other point is this idea you were just discussing, and this idea of sovereignty. And that has been lost. It's lost in our country. We don't have a sovereign nation anymore because we've lost our constitution. So go ahead. I'm sorry to just wanted to interject.
Oh, no. Well, that's the point Ray McGovern had made. He said, you know, we had these, you know, law itself is just disappearing. I mean, you know, Magna Carta, the Treaty of Westphalia, said the Constitution, forget it. You know, he showed these video clips of, you know, the famous thing of Clapper being asked, you know, in the Congress, are you collecting any type of information on millions of Americans? And he says, no. Not wittingly. No, that was just that was a complete lie. Or he had a clip of Michael Hayden saying that, oh, no, there's nothing about reasonable cause in the Constitution. And maybe you need to read that amendment again, because there most certainly is. That, you know, if you don't, you know, laws on paper don't have power. You know, you have to, are you going to back them up? Or are you going to demand their, you know, are you going to demand that the principles behind them really be respected? And if you don't, you lose it. I mean, you know, America's, you know, it's obviously not hopeless here, but if we don't change, this is fascism in the United States. I mean, the world's would be in a much different position overall. All these problems, you know, the vast majority of these things simply wouldn't be issues, at least ones that couldn't be dealt with, if the U.S. made a 180, you know, said, oh, great, we'd love to work with the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. We'd love to work with the National Development Bank. Best of luck to you. You know, we'd like to assist with our knowledge in several areas to help with these development programs. If the U.S. did that, the world could be a different and much better place. And there's no, you know, law of nature that says that's impossible.
Well, you're listening to Jason Ross from Lyndon LaRouche's Basement Team. You know, you brought up this ongoing polemic that Mr. LaRouche has had against pragmatism and popular opinion. And, you know, if you look at the way the United States is functioning right now, you take these three great crises. We're being lied to about Ebola. In fact, day after day, the CDC is changing what they're saying about it. So, you know, is that just incompetence? Is that just confusion? No, it's lying. On ISIS, the fact that Biden came out and said at Harvard what everyone knows, which is that Obama is depending on the countries that created ISIS to destroy it, which is not going to happen. And then on the financial situation, Obama's touring the country saying, we've made great progress, we're in a great recovery, and Americans either have no job or four jobs, and they still can't make ends meet. So here we are where popular opinion is killing us. Now, how difficult, Jason, is it to shift to a worldview based on these concepts such as energy flux density and the Promethean idea?
Well, you know, it's difficult in one sense in that it does, since we don't have a culture where we've been, certainly for younger people, where we've been brought up with that as an identity, it can be a real shock and a real shift, because to say that you know even one thing that goes against popular opinion, on, you know, on something that matters, not, you know, most people like this, you know, singer and I don't. Well, you know, but on a serious matter, to make that step to say that, no, this is, you know, this is how it is, this is how it is, to make the step to say that on even one thing requires that you're now saying of yourself, wow, I'm capable of coming to conclusions that are my own, that vary with others, people might disagree with me. What's the basis that I can stand on to think that? And the only basis of that is the process of discovery. That's how you actually know anything. You know, in the Alcibiades dialogue, Socrates is talking to Alcibiades, and he basically points out that Alcibiades doesn't know anything because he's got a lot of opinions, but none of them came out of having a problem and discovering an answer to it, and then having that as the basis of, that's the basis of knowledge. And so we need to create that in science, you know, totally reform science education. And we're doing that within and beyond the movement. We're, you know, leading the process to bring back the, to implement the study of Kepler, the first modern scientist. We're doing it in culture. And I think that the power of Fidelio, the performance of Fidelio, it went beyond the story itself, which is it's a great story. But then it goes beyond that. You know, it has the same sort of character of the rightness of a scientific discovery, and you get it through culture. You can get it from these different avenues. But if you don't have it, you don't have this ability to be certain of something.
Isn't that what Lyndon LaRouche always says about creativity, that the creative discovery in the classical sciences and in classical culture really is one and the same process?
Yeah. I mean, if you're working on a piece of music and, it's like, do you get it or do you not? I mean, there's not always just one way to get it. You keep coming back and sort of getting more out of it. And not just because the composer knew more than you, they would also always find that there's more there, because you're getting a reflection of something greater than yourself when you make a real composition. It came from outside of you. I mean, you had to do it, but it also did reflect something that's bigger than you. So that feeling of uncovering that and finding it is very important.
Well, you know, I'd like you, we have just a little bit of time left, and I'd like you to just reflect on your experience of attending this conference as to, now you're back in the United States, you're back in the land of the clueless. How do we communicate these ideas? How do we get people to understand that there is something new coming into the world with this BRICS development, but it's something new that is totally is totally coherent with the traditions of the of our founding documents, our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, our great presidents from Washington, John Quincy Adams, Lincoln, FDR, John F. Kennedy. How do we communicate this?
Well, the first step would, of course, be to watch the conference. So that would be, I'd say, step number one. Read through the thing. It might take, a number of days. I mean, it was like two completely full days of stuff. So, to go through it, it's going to take a while. But, set aside the time, get through it at whatever pace you're able to. And I think something will appear to you. I mean, the sense of what was between the notes of the thing also, what it felt like, I think will come if you go through it. And, including I don't think any of the discussion sessions have been posted yet. They're starting with the presentations. But when it's all up there, it'll all get up there. To really take the time to get through that. I mean, the other thing is, of course, the discussions that weren't on camera. Just the discussions during it. The incredible attention that people paid. I mean, I was amazed. During the presentations, people were listening. People, I mean, often, you know, at these conferences, a lot of people are hanging out in the lobby, chatting about all sorts of things. There was pretty good attention at this one. And the chatting in the lobby was about, you know, was good. So, yeah, I don't think there's, I can't think of any short thing to say, but if you take the time to experience the conference yourself, I think you'll, I think everybody will be much better for it.
You know, Jason, I just to conclude, and I'd like your thoughts on this because you've gone through this. Ultimately, as Lynn has been saying, it's not a question of describing creativity. You have to experience a creative moment. And that, you know, the one of the problems we have is in language communicating these ideas. But there is this potential that you can find in yourself that's missing in most of us, this ability to latch on to that higher conception of mankind. And go ahead, give me your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, again, it's hard to talk about it, right? But the, you know, I just think that when going through that experience, it more than anything else gives a sense of what it is to be a person and that we're all human. You know, some forms of, you know, cultural exchange, like, you know, comparing different cooking styles or, you know, getting together around the World Cup or, I don't know, some of these things that people might think are, you know, they're ways of, you know, international unity, et cetera. And not really. I mean, there's nothing bad about sharing, you know, recipes with people from other places. And, you know, I mean, that's not bad. Nothing wrong with having good food from another place. But that's not the most human aspect of yourself. It's necessary and important. But the, you know, the real thing that you get and that came from this conference with people from so many different cultures is that, you know, the thing that comes across as the unifier is that intent to discover something about what the future should be like. And people came with different views on that. People came with different, you know, specific attitudes towards it or projects specific to their nation that they, you know, contributed their particular understanding to. But, you know, the fact that we were together to work on and discuss a new global strategic architecture and financial architecture, I think that as a whole was a participation in a creative process. It was making something new. And it wasn't exactly music. It wasn't exactly science. It was statecraft, and it was a creative application of that.
Well, that's actually quite a useful idea. you know, we're almost out of time. What are you working on now in the basement? Just I know people should be looking at the weekly New Paradigm show, but are you working on anything in particular?
Well, I'm working on getting over jet lag. I think more more generally, what we're, you know, the weekly report, the New Paradigm show last week, I thought was really excellent, putting viruses in a broader context. You know, viruses can kill, and most of our experience with them is their deadliness. But just as weather, and, you know, you look at droughts in the broader context of what are weather systems and how can we control them, the same thing makes sense to get a real breakthrough in biology. I mean, we don't overall have a very good ability to deal with viruses right now. And putting the study of viruses in the broader context of the fact that, you know, these figures Leona gave, that if you added up all of the mass of all the viruses in the oceans, it would be 75 million blue whales worth of virus. You know, there's a lot of virus out there. Most of it doesn't make us sick. Viruses have played an essential role in evolution in the parallel, in the sideways, you know, transmission of things. And that if we broaden that out and look at them as a more universal phenomenon in life as a whole, that will, you know, would undoubtedly provide a, you know, different approaches to treating the ones that kill us. So I think that's the focus of ours. The next thing we're going to be doing is, and we got to figure out how to bring more of our networks of supporters and organizers into it, is continuing to work on Kepler's method, on his harmonies of the world. And that's something that it's an opportunity go through the discovery with Kepler, and we're putting together, you know, a working, like a, you know, I would say, a syllabus and worksheets and all that kind of thing to make it possible to have a real education around it.
Well, let me just mention one other thing in concluding the program today. I would urge everybody to go to the LaRouchePAC.com website to get the emergency war plan that was just drafted by Deborah Freeman on how to take on this Ebola crisis in the broadest sense. And I think it really does reflect the kind of discussion we've had on this program, the need for international collaboration on the highest level. So it's an emergency war plan. It's on the LaRouchePAC.com website. And then go also, while you're on LaRouchePAC.com, to hear the webcast from last night where Jason takes up this whole question of the Schiller Institute conference. So we're out of time, Jason. Thanks for joining us today, and I hope you get over the jet lag.
Thanks, Arlie.
And join us next week on the LaRouche Show, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's it for now.